Welcome to I Wish They Knew, a show where leaders in business and education share big ideas that deserve more attention in about the time it takes to enjoy a cup of coffee. I'm Joe Hirsch. Today's wish comes from Dr. David Berkus. David is the best-selling author of 5 books about business and leadership. His work has been featured in numerous print and TV media, including The Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, USA Today, Fast Company, CNN, and CBS This Morning. And he's been ranked by Thinkers 50 as one of the world's top business thought leaders for a bunch of years now. David is a TEDx and international speaker who's worked with leaders from organizations across all industries, including Google, Stryker, Fidelity, Viacom, and even the U.S. Naval Academy. David's latest book is Best Team Ever, The Surprising Science of High-Performing Teams, which I enjoyed a great deal. I think you will too. And we had him on the show way back on episode 19, which was light years ago. We're happy to have him back here again today. David, thanks for being on the show today. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And by the way, I wish I knew how you managed to drink a cup of coffee in this short a period of time. I feel like this is the amount of time it takes to cool a cup of coffee, like that it's, if you're waiting for it to cool to where it's drinkable. But you and I obviously like our coffee at different temperatures.
Yeah, it's more of a chug, not a sip. So, welcome back and congrats on the book. It's excellent. What do you wish more people knew?
I wish more people knew that trust isn't given and trust isn't earned. It's reciprocated. We talk about building trust all the time. And I think we feel like if we all just do some trust falls, take a personality test, have a discussion, will increase trust. It's not. It's a reciprocal process. It's a cycle. And it has to, especially on work teams, it has to be done really deliberately or else it can backfire really fast.
So the best teams are high trust teams, but you think we should be going about that in a different way?
Yeah, absolutely. And really, when we talk about trust at work, the best teams are high trust teams, but really the best teams exhibit a high amount of what Amy Edmondson would call psychological safety, right? The best teams have a feeling that it's safe for interpersonal risk taking. And that's the thing, right? That word risk actually carries a huge amount of weight because you can say that we have a high level of trust on the team, but until somebody actually takes a risk, speaks up when they disagree, right? Shares a crazy idea, admits a failure, shows a vulnerability, right? Until those things happen, you don't actually have trust or you don't actually know it. And it turns out that not only is it how a team responds on the other end of risk that determines whether or not they're a high trust team, it also determines whether or not they grow or diminish in the level of trust they have in the team. So that response is worth far more. And that's why I say it's reciprocated, right? Trust actually happens in the moment someone's vulnerable and that vulnerability is met with honor and respect. And they hear you, even if they disagree with you, they hear you. That's what actually builds trust. Before that, it's really just, do I like the person? It's not actually, do I trust them?
So take me deeper into this concept of risk, because in the book you talk about the nature of self-disclosure and how leaders can actually earn trust by signaling that vulnerability. How would you reassure a leader out there who's worried that this sort of self-disclosure and this risk-taking might diminish their own credibility with their teams?
Yeah. No, I get it, right? So that's one of the things we talk about, this cycle, trust, risk, respect, right? That we just got at. And often if you have a team where trust is low or a team you've newly inherited, so they don't know you, the easiest way to get that cycle going is to go first, to be vulnerable yourself. And unfortunately, when I say that, a lot of people think that I mean like bring your whole self to work right away. That's the goal. It'd be great to strive for that. But like, at first, maybe bring your whole self on a first date, right? Like bring your whole self as it might, but you could still, you don't have to share deal breaking levels of vulnerability. You could still share smaller scale things. So you're not talking about how I feel like my parents never loved me. I never had a date to junior prom. You're talking about how like, hey, the reason I'm so slow to reply to emails is that I never actually learned to touch type and I still have tons of typos and what have you. And it's easier for me to have a phone call. You know what I mean? Like that's a vulnerability that still shows, wow, they're trusting me with some information about their weaknesses, not deal breaker weaknesses, but they're still small scale. And so that's the thing. You just have to start smaller than you may think. If it whatever level you're comfortable with, maybe one click past that is the right level, but you don't have to go all the way to 100 right away.
And about respect, I mean, how is the best way to achieve that kind of respect? Is it simply by treating others the way they want to be treated?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we're talking about, I usually like to frame this risk as like, let's assume we're in conversation with people, right? So yeah, there is treating people how they want to be treated, but it's meeting their risk with respect, right? And so what we're really talking about here is how much you're helping them feel heard, right? Like the easiest way to have someone feel disrespected when they're being vulnerable is you're not even listening to them. You're looking at your phone, you're on Zoom. And so you're looking at your email inbox instead of listening to them, what have you, or you're jumping in with advice right away instead of asking follow-up questions and summarizing and signaling that you're interested in what have you. And so again, small scale way to start, but I would just start there. Right? If you can model active listening to everybody in your team, not only when someone takes that risk, are you helping them feel respected? You're showing the rest of the team what proper behavior is when people are speaking up and disagreeing or when they're sharing those crazy ideas. The number one reason, Christine Porath, who's like the world's most respected researcher on respect at the workplace, the number one reason she cites consistently for people committing disrespectful behavior is that they're just modeling the people on the top. Right. And so that makes modeling proper behavior even more important.
Yeah. We had her back on the show. Gosh, it was also a while back, but we'll link up to that episode in the show notes. So how teams handle conflict is also either a trust builder or a trust breaker. What are some techniques that allow teams to maintain respect even when there's no consensus?
Yeah. I mean, this is the hardest time, right? It's hard to model active listening and hard to help someone feel heard when you just want them to shut up because they're wrong, right? And so there are base level instincts we have to kind of fight against here. And the biggest thing I would say is, again, continue to model active listening, continue to ask questions, what have you, when it's your turn to sort of push back on that idea, because I don't think you should just let it go unstated. If you disagree with it, that's fine. Conflict and how a team handles conflict actually has a huge determinant on whether or not they trust each other more, because conflict is a great opportunity for that trust, risk, respect cycle to run, right? So in addition to modeling active listening, though, when you push back on the idea, don't push back on the idea, and certainly don't push back on the person. Start from assumptions. Like the questions you're going to ask first before you even give your take, or just ask them questions. Hey, Joe, that's a really interesting idea. Do we know what kind of budget we have for this project? Because it sounds like your idea might lead to a cost overrun, or it sounds like we may not have, do we know how many people we have to work on this project? Because it sounds like that might take more work than we have capacity for. You know, those little questions that give them an opportunity to actually further defend their idea, right? But come from those assumptions you made. That's a great way to sort of push back on the idea. What'll happen is either they'll go, no, I ran the numbers and here's the budget and it's under. And maybe you find out you're wrong, which is fine, right? Because the best idea should win. Or they go and go, oh yeah, you're right. You know, I wasn't really thinking about budget. It would cost this. Yeah, that's way, they'll realize the error of their idea, but they still feel heard. They still feel considered. This isn't you going, no, that'll never work because we don't have the money for it, right as soon as you hear the idea, which is the quickest way to make sure somebody doesn't come back to you. In fact, that's actually my number one thing for leaders who are listening to this, and hopefully your coffee is cooler by now. For leaders who are listening to this, my number one question when I'm working with them around trust and psychological safety is, when was the last time someone disagreed with you publicly? Right. If it was 6 months ago, that tells me that 6 months ago you didn't handle it well and no one wants to disagree publicly anymore. But even if it was, you know, oh yeah, that happened last week. Great. Tell me more about that, because how a leader in particular responds to someone whose idea differs from theirs sets the tone for whether or not we have trust on the team, but also whether or not we get more great ideas in the future or not.
Yeah. It's almost like treating conflict as collaboration.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Well, you already said it. I didn't just wonder if the way to do it is to treat conflict as collaboration. Here's how we do it. We don't push back on the idea, et cetera. And we don't take it personally, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. You know, I think there's this tendency. I joke sometimes that ideas are sort of are ugly babies, right? There's this tendency that you're never supposed to call a baby ugly.
There
right?
are no but, ugly babies.
Yeah. There's no ugly babies. There are babies that make beautiful toddlers. Right?
They're not yet and beautiful.
Right, right. But ideas are the same way, right? And the solution isn't to pass judgment on them right away, just like there are no ugly babies. The solution is to recognize that some ideas need time to develop and they need a little bit of questioning of the assumptions so we can think through them further, but it's not yet time to render judgment on them. Unfortunately, when we call the baby ugly, what do? We offended the person, and that person will never show us pictures of their kids again.
So failure is a great teacher, but it's also a really strong unifier. Talk about some of the ways that teams can grow closer to each other and trust each other more by embracing that kind of failure.
Yeah. You know, my dad had this, we have these dadisms. I don't know if you have this too, like, you know,
all just, the time.
Yeah. So my dad always had these dadisms that used to bug the heck out of me when I was a teenager. And one of them was, failure is a great teacher and tuition's half off if it's someone else's failure.
Ooh, right? That's good.
Right. I know. Well, when I was 13, it seemed stupid.
Not so good.
Right? But then I'm researching this book and I'm realizing, no, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Right. It turns out that, I mean, the idea is that we have a team that has such high levels of trust, people don't feel like they have to cover their butt, that they realize they're going to be forgiven for mistakes and failures. And also, we're going to learn as a team. We're going to extract lessons. We're going to have that after action review and espouse certain things, right? So I think there's a reframe here that needs to happen. And I'm a big fan. We talk about him in the conclusion of the book. I'm a big fan of Gary Ridge's reframe of failures as learning moments. And the idea is sort of blanket amnesty to anyone who fesses up to a failure, but they don't say, I failed here. They say, hey, team, I had a learning moment. Here's what happened and what I learned. Right. And you're not going to get sort of like fired for that. That's not going to get added to your performance review. And as soon as you have five learning moments, you're fired. Right. It's just, okay, great. Thank you. So your failure enabled our team to learn more. And there's almost an appreciation for that. Right. Like in the book, I actually say celebrate failures, maybe not celebrate failures. Like you're consistently incompetent. Here's a trophy. But when those failures happen, because they're inevitable, you celebrate when people are transparent enough to extract those lessons, because what you get is not only the learning, you get a more bonded team because people realize, oh, I don't have to cover my failures here. I can trust this team more. So you get really two things, not only the learning, you get that trust too. And you get it again for less tuition than going out and failing on your own and having to learn the lesson personally.
So along those same lines about, you know, acknowledging that we fail and that we're fallible and we need others to help us, you talk about a concept in the book called help time. I really love that because it's sort of a grassroots employee to employee trust building technique. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So help time. I learned this from IDEO. Well, actually from Teresa Immobile at Harvard, but she was, you know, studying and working with IDEO, and they had this sort of help time concept. And the idea is, it's sort of stolen and modified from Google. Google has that famous 20% time. But of course, if you talk to anyone at Google, they'll tell you it's 120% time, because you can work on whatever you want. You just have to do it in addition to your duties. But the idea with help time is what if we dedicate a set period of time, a set percentage of time on our calendar to jump in on other projects, right? To, you know, I'm not working with this team directly, but I'm going to jump in on their brainstorming session and just provide some outside views and what have you. And it does a couple great things. Like, first of all, it cross-pollinates ideas better than almost anything else inside an organization, because you're getting somebody from a totally different department playing the sort of useful idiot, right? That asking the dumb questions, but questioning the taken for granted assumptions and causing us to think more about it. You also get an understanding of how your work fits into the larger whole better, because you're seeing what those other teams are doing. And then lastly, and this is great for sort of, it's like a side-by-side way to grow trust throughout a whole organization. What you get is just a personal affinity for people. We have this huge problem in large organizations with silos where there's us versus them. And one of the fundamental reasons is just, we don't actually know anyone over there, right? And so it's really easy to put someone in the outsider category if you don't know them. But if Joe was in on our focus group last month, and I really liked meeting Joe, and Joe works with all of those people, and Joe's a good person, well, then they must be too. Otherwise, Joe would have a problem with them. So that must be a good group too. And so you get this kind of, not only a team bonding, but like a whole organization-wide bonding just by volunteering. And we're not talking about 20%, by the way. We're talking about 1, 2, 3, 5% maybe. We're talking about an hour, hour and a half a week. And you can start to grow that level of trust, but also that cross-pollination of ideas.
You probably also feel a lot better just about where you work and the level of support that people are willing to provide to one another.
I mean, the one thing I'll say about help time is if you decide to do it and no one reciprocates, you might end up really frustrated after like 18 months. But if you're in a leadership, if you can roll this out among certain people and it's seen as reciprocated, yeah, absolutely. You feel much better about the culture of support, especially if you can pair that, by the way, with teaching people how to express gratitude far more often. You can really grow, again, how supported people feel inside the whole organization, not just the team they're on.
The book is Best Team Ever, and the author is the best of them all, David Burkus. David, thanks for sharing your wish with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show. It helps others find us. For more ideas on how to communicate with impact, visit my website, joehirsch.me. See you next time.